Welcome to The Site of the Crime, your weekly Florida and federal criminal case law update podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Lesnetsky of Lesnetsky Guy in Law, and each week I'm going to release one episode reviewing the previous week's decisions coming out of the six Florida District Courts of Appeal and the Florida Supreme Court, and one episode reviewing the previous week's 11th Circuit Court of Appeals and U.S. Supreme Court decisions. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode of The Site of the Crime. Welcome back to The Site of the Crime. This is our federal 11th Circuit criminal case law update for the week of January 16th, 2023 through January 20th, 2023. And last week we had 11 cases that we're going to talk about today. There are three published decisions and eight unpublished decisions. And some of these cases involve, for example, a guideline versus guideline commentary rumble. We have a case about one really expensive Pokemon card. We have a case involving the dangers of carrying sandwich bags in one's car. And we had a case involving anthrax, the disease, not the band. And much more. So we've got a lot of cases to get through, and let's get started. All right, so our first case today is United States v. Dupree. This is an 11th Circuit published decision from January 18th, 2023. And Dupree is a mega en banc case involving the interplay between the sentencing guidelines and the sentencing guideline commentary. And a huge shout out to Assistant Federal Public Defender Conrad Kahn, who argued this case and was successful. So have you ever wondered what legal significance the commentary in the guidelines has related to the actual guideline provisions? Well, this case answers that question. In Dupree, the 11th Circuit wrestled with the question of whether an inchoate offense qualifies as a controlled substance offense for career offender purposes under the guidelines. A person is a career offender if they have at least two prior felony convictions for either a crime of violence or a controlled substance offense, and the instant offense is a felony that is either a crime of violence or a controlled substance offense. So Mr. Dupree was charged with conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute a controlled substance and was sentenced as a career offender because he had two prior controlled substance convictions. But on appeal, he argued that his conspiracy charge was not a controlled substance offense because Section 4B1.2B, which defines a controlled substance offense, doesn't include in the plain text the word conspiracy. If Congress meant to include it, they would have included it. Not so fast, says the government. All we need to do is look to the commentary. Application note number 1 of Section 4B1.2 states that a crime of violence and a controlled substance offense includes the offenses of aiding and abetting, conspiring, and attempting to commit such crimes. So conspiracy is included in the application note in the commentary of the guidelines, but it's not included in the actual guideline. So which controls? The plain language of the guideline or the added language in the application note? Initially, a panel of the 11th Circuit held that the language in the application note was binding, so Mr. Dupree lost. But the 11th decided to rehear the case en banc and vacated that opinion. So here we are with a fresh slate. So the 11th Circuit began with the Supreme Court's decision in Stinson v. United States, a 1993 case where the court held that the guideline commentary should receive the same level of deference given to an agency's interpretation of its own rules. How a court should view that interpretation was first laid out by the Supreme Court in a case called Seminole Rock. In that case, the Supreme Court held that a court should first consider whether the meaning of the regulation is in doubt, and if the regulation is ambiguous, then the court can consider the agency's interpretation of it and should give that interpretation great deference and should disturb it only if it is inconsistent with the regulation or plainly erroneous. Seminole Rock was then reaffirmed in a case called Auer, and the deference to an agency's interpretation of a regulation is now referred to as our deference. So how does a court determine whether there is ambiguity in the regulation? Well, it uses the traditional tools of construction, like in any case where you're looking at the text of a statute. And after that, if there is no ambiguity, then there is no Auer deference. In other words, if the regulation is not ambiguous, the courts will not look to the agency's interpretation of that regulation. So the question before the 11th Circuit is whether this same approach applies to the sentencing guidelines. Or are the sentencing guidelines different and shouldn't be treated the same as any other regulation? And the 11th Circuit said, yes, it does apply to the guidelines. And they relied on another Supreme Court case, Kisor, K-I-S-O-R. And they held that the analysis applies to the sentencing guidelines just as it does to any other regulation. Now, the dissent in this case believes that the majority essentially overruled Stinson, the Supreme Court case that held that the commentary should be given the same weight as the guidelines. But the majority responded that its decision flows harmoniously from Stinson, followed by Seminole Rock, Auer, and Kisor, which developed the case law to establish that there is no deference to an agency's interpretation of its regulation unless there is ambiguity in that regulation. So this is huge news in the federal sentencing world. From now on, in the 11th Circuit, when arguing sentencing enhancements and other guideline issues and whether that guideline applies, we must start with arguing whether the actual guideline is ambiguous. If it is not, the court should ignore the commentary and only look at the plain language of the guideline text. If the guideline is ambiguous, then the court can look at the guideline commentary and give it the deference required under Stinson, Auer, Seminole Rock, and Kisor. Now, this is a double-edged sword. Certainly for Dupree and any other person that has prior conspiracy convictions that previously would have made him a career offender, this is a good thing. But it cuts both ways. If there is a provision that is not ambiguous and the guideline commentary actually helps your client, the government's going to argue Dupree and that the plain text controls. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. But narrowing in on the outcome of this decision from now on in the 11th Circuit, and unless or until the issue reaches the Supreme Court, aiding and abetting, conspiracy, or attempt to commit a crime of violence or controlled substance offense will not serve as a predicate offense for career offender designation. Case vacated and remanded. Our second case today is United States v. Adamseen. This is an 11th Circuit published decision that was released January 18th, 2023. And Adamseen is a procedural and substantive reasonableness of the sentence case. Now, I don't typically cover these type of cases, reasonableness of the sentence cases, on the podcast, because quite frankly, they are all almost identical. But what I do is give links to every published and unpublished case in the show notes, so you can always take a look at those cases that I don't cover that are, you know, just kind of run-of-the-mill cases that would take up a little too much time in the podcast if I covered every single one of them. But this was a published decision, so we'll cover it. And Mr. Adamseen was sentenced to 36 months for wire fraud. This was an upward variance from his guideline range of 8 to 14 months. His maximum sentence was 240 months. As for his procedural reasonableness claim, the district court considered the party's arguments, the guidelines, the guideline range, the PSR, and the 3553A factors, and determined that Mr. Adamseen used his education, ability, and background to steal money from a national benevolence fund, taking $85,000 designed to save the economy during the pandemic. It was supposed to go to small businesses to help them stay afloat. The district court determined that an upward variance was necessary for general deterrence purposes. And although the district court didn't address each 3553A factor, it's not required to do so. And for Mr. Adamseen's argument that this was a run-of-the-mill fraud case, that argument fell on deaf ears, as the 11th determined not only that there was no plain error, but that there was no error at all. So the court next turned to the substantive reasonableness claim, and Mr. Adamseen claimed that the district court varied upwards because the court didn't like him. because he spent $57,789 of the stolen money to buy one single Pokemon card. Seriously. The guy stole COVID relief funds to buy a Pokemon card. Well, apparently the 11th Circuit didn't like him either. Because, and I quote, "It would not be surprising or disqualifying if a judge did not like a person who defrauded a federal program of funds intended to promote the public good and help small businesses, particularly when the stolen funds were used for the purpose of purchasing a $57,789 Pokemon card," end quote. So it's okay if the district judge doesn't like you. Not a basis for appeal, apparently. And here, as the 11th Circuit almost always does, the court upheld the substantive reasonableness of the sentence, noting that the 36 months, although higher than the guidelines, was far below the 240-month statutory maximum. So case affirmed. Our third case today is United States v. Scott. This is an 11th Circuit published decision that was released January 20th, 2023. And Scott is a healthcare fraud case that ended in a conviction after a five-day trial. Mr. Scott was charged with submitting fraudulent claims to Medicare for genetic cancer screening tests for beneficiaries that didn't have cancer or any family history of cancer, and those tests were not ordered by the beneficiary's primary care physicians. The genetic cancer screening tests would simply assess the risk of developing cancer, and they weren't covered under Medicare, claimed the government. Mr. Scott was convicted, and on appeal, he challenged his healthcare fraud convictions, but he didn't appeal the kickback convictions for paying people to refer patients for the screening tests. So Mr. Scott claims on appeal that the indictment failed to state the charged offense and that the evidence was insufficient. Both claims rely on his argument that because Medicare does cover the genetic screening tests, he didn't commit a crime. But he didn't present any evidence at trial or request a jury instruction that Medicare actually did generally cover those tests. As an initial matter, Mr. Scott did not file a motion to dismiss the indictment. But the 11th Circuit precedent allows a defendant to challenge the indictment for the first time on appeal, but it's under the very high plain error standard. So at trial, the government presented evidence that the genetic screening tests are not listed as covered services in the Medicare regulations. Medicare provides medically necessary services for people over 65 or for people who have disabilities, and it covers diagnostic tests or services that are reasonable and necessary for the diagnosis of illness or injury. Diagnostic tests are only covered when ordered by a physician who is treating the beneficiary for a specific medical problem, and the results of the test will be used in the management of that specific medical problem. Mr. Scott's indictment alleged that Medicare did not cover diagnostic testing that was not reasonable or necessary for the diagnosis or treatment of an illness or injury or to improve the functioning of a malformed body member. So the indictment just tracked the language of the regulation. The indictment also alleged that Medicare required the test to be ordered by a treating physician, and if it wasn't, then the test is not reasonable and necessary. The indictment then alleged that Mr. Scott conspired with others to submit claims to Medicare for genetic tests that were not medically necessary. So Mr. Scott on appeal argues that the indictment fails to charge healthcare fraud because genetic testing is not diagnostic and is considered a grade AB preventive testing by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, and therefore, it is covered by Medicare. So that's his claim on appeal. But the 11th Circuit found this argument unpersuasive because he did not demonstrate that the genetic tests are actually covered by Medicare. We're not going to get too far into the weeds on grade A, B tests, but the 11th noted that Mr. Scott did not provide any federal statutes or regulations supporting his position that the genetic tests are grade AB tests, and that they are not diagnostic tests. Therefore, the indictment was sufficient. Similarly, the evidence at trial was sufficient. The matter of Medicare coverage has to be resolved at trial. In other words, Mr. Scott is free to present evidence that the testing is covered by Medicare, just as the government is entitled to present evidence that the testing is not covered by Medicare. And then it's up to the jury to decide. And here, Mr. Scott didn't present any evidence, including the USPSTF's recommendation, that the genetic tests were covered. The evidence established that Mr. Scott owned the company, a telemarketing company that marketed the genetic tests to potential customers. His employees purchased Medicare beneficiary lists from data brokers, called those beneficiaries, and then recruited them to accept shipment of the test to their homes. Mr. Scott paid kickbacks to a company that provided doctor's orders authorizing the tests, but those telemarketing doctors were not the beneficiaries' primary care physicians, and they never actually talked to or saw the beneficiaries. Medicare was billed for more than $3 million, paying a minimum of $1,500 per test. The 11th Circuit held that this was sufficient evidence to support conviction. Mr. Scott paid kickbacks, and a jury could infer that he knew the doctor's orders were illegitimate because of those kickbacks, which he admitted he knew was improper, and because he knew the telemedicine doctors had no previous relationship with the beneficiaries, and they had no history of cancer or family history of cancer. So the 11th Circuit held that both the indictment and the evidence at trial were sufficient to support Mr. Scott's conviction. Case affirmed. Our fourth case today is United States v. Bader. This is an 11th Circuit unpublished decision that was released on January 18, 2023. And Bader is a disclosure of grand jury materials case. Mr. Bader was charged with corruptly endeavoring to impede the due administration of the Internal Revenue Laws, willful attempt to evade income taxes, and security instrument fraud. He was convicted on all counts and sentenced to 120 months in prison. His direct appeal was affirmed, and he made a pro se motion for a copy of all grand jury transcripts in his case, alleging that the government committed perjury before the grand jury. The district court denied the motion, and Mr. Bader appealed. The government then moved for summary affirmance. On appeal, Mr. Bader argues that the grand jury transcripts will show that he is actually innocent and he needs them for a future 2255 motion. Grand jury proceedings are secret and should only be disclosed in limited circumstances. But under Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 6E3E1, a district court can authorize disclosure of a grand jury matter preliminarily to or in connection with a judicial proceeding if the party seeking disclosure shows a particularized need for the material. And a particularized need exists when the material is needed to avoid a possible injustice in another proceeding, the need of disclosure is greater than the need for secrecy, and the request is structured to cover only material actually needed. Unsubstantiated allegations do not satisfy the particularized need standard. So you can't just say, I need the grand jury transcripts because I know the witnesses lied. You have to provide specifics and back those specifics up. This is a tall task when you don't know what exactly was said in the grand jury proceedings. Also, if a defendant is found guilty at trial, then any error in the grand jury proceedings is harmless because the jury found the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a higher standard than the probable cause standard found by the grand jury. Here, the 11th Circuit granted the government's motion for summary affirmance because Mr. Bader only made a blanket request for all grand jury information and didn't demonstrate any particularized need for that information. And at any rate, he was convicted by a jury, so any error, if any, was harmless. Summary affirmance granted. Our fifth case today is United States v. Bivens. This is an 11th Circuit unpublished decision that was released January 20th, 2023. And Bivens is a legality of the standard condition of supervised release case. Mr. Bivens was on supervised release, and one of the standard conditions is that he cannot interact or communicate with known felons. But what if your boyfriend or girlfriend is a convicted felon? Surely a trial court can't prevent you from interacting with your significant other. Well, that is what Mr. Bivens argued, for the first time on appeal. Mr. Bivens' boyfriend was a convicted felon, so Mr. Bivens couldn't interact with him while on supervised release. And he was found to have violated this condition of his supervised release, and he appealed to the 11th Circuit, arguing that the district court erred by not excluding his boyfriend from that standard condition. Mr. Bivens argued that the standard conditions of probation also were an improper delegation of judicial authority to the probation officer. Unfortunately for Mr. Bivens, because he didn't object at the trial level, the plain error review standard applied. Under Section 5D1.3, subsection C, Standard Condition 8 states that the defendant shall not communicate or interact with someone the defendant knows is engaged in criminal activity. If the defendant knows someone has been convicted of a felony, the defendant shall not knowingly communicate or interact with that person without first getting the permission of the probation officer. Here under the plain error standard, because there is no 11th Circuit or Supreme Court decision on point finding that a district court errs by failing to exclude a person from Standard Condition 8, there is no plain error. The court next turned to Standard Condition 12, which under Section 5D1.3 subsection C states that if a probation officer determines that the defendant poses a risk to another person, including an organization, the probation officer may require the defendant to notify the person about the risk, and the defendant shall comply with that instruction. The probation officer may contact the person and confirm that the defendant has notified the person about the risk. So, can the judge delegate the authority to decide whether a person poses a risk to a probation officer, or is that power reserved to the judge? Well, the 11th Circuit has distinguished between ministerial acts or support service that can be delegated to a probation officer and ultimate responsibility of imposing sentence that can't be delegated. Under Article 3, courts may not delegate the ultimate responsibility of judicial functions to probation officers, but they may delegate duties to support judicial functions as long as the judge retains and exercises ultimate responsibility. In Nash, an 11th Circuit case, the 11th Circuit held that it was proper for the judge to delegate the power to notify third parties of Mr. Nash's criminal record as directed by the probation officer. So Mr. Nash's probation officer got to decide whether he or she was going to tell Mr. Nash's employer, friends, family, etc. about his criminal conviction, and this is fine according to the 11th Circuit under the Nash decision. In Mr. Bivens' case, because he didn't object, plain error again rears its ugly head, and because there is no binding precedent on point supporting Mr. Bivens' argument, there is no plain error. But even if that wasn't, if the case wasn't reviewed under the plain error standard, the court went on to find that under the Nash decision, it was not improper delegation of the judicial authority to allow the probation officer to determine when, where, and to whom notice must be given. So case affirmed. Our sixth case today is United States v. Fairley. This is an 11th Circuit unpublished decision that was released January 17, 2023. Fairley is a motion to withdraw plea case involving a solicitation to have sex with a minor. Mr. Fairley lived with his girlfriend and her children, which included a teen daughter. Mr. Fairley had sex with the daughter of his girlfriend, who was 16 years old at the time. He plied her with alcohol, marijuana, money, and cash. One of the outstanding assistant federal public defenders in Jacksonville originally represented Mr. Fairley during the change of plea hearing. And during the colloquy, the magistrate judge saw a look of hesitancy on Mr. Fairley's face. So the proceeding was continued to give Mr. Fairley more time to discuss the change of plea with his attorney. The case came back before the magistrate judge for a subsequent change of plea hearing, and the judge went through the whole plea colloquy. Nobody has threatened or coerced you, this is what you want to do, et cetera, that we hear in all of these very long, very detailed plea colloquies. And the magistrate judge found that the plea was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. To his attorney's credit, the attorney didn't waive the 14-day objection period, which is almost always done in a change of plea hearing. So Mr. Fairley had 14 days to object to the magistrate's recommendation for the district court to accept the plea. About 30 days later, the initial PSR comes out, and 2 weeks after that, His attorney moved to withdraw as counsel, and conflict counsel was appointed. Before sentencing, Mr. Farrelly moved to withdraw his plea, and the district court held three hearings on the issue. Mr. Farrelly argued that he entered the plea because the government threatened and coerced him and his family and his friends. Both Mr. Farrelly and his original public defender testified at the hearings, but the district court denied the motion to withdraw the plea and sentenced Mr. Farrelly to 30 years in prison. In order to withdraw a guilty plea before sentencing, Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 11 subsection D2B requires the defendant to show a fair and just reason. The 11th Circuit has determined four factors known as the Buckles factors to determine whether there is a fair and just reason. First, whether close assistance of counsel was available. Second, whether the plea was knowing and voluntary. Third, whether judicial resources would be conserved. And four, whether the government would be prejudiced if the defendant were allowed to withdraw the plea. And the first two factors are considered the most important. In this case, Mr. Farrelly didn't want to withdraw his plea until after the PSR came out. And because he waited until after the district court accepted his plea to object, any issue with his prior attorney not explaining the 14-day objection period had no effect. The 11th Circuit also found that Mr. Farrelly's original attorney provided close assistance of counsel. And Mr. Buckle's own words during the plea colloquy weigh against him, because he swore under oath that his plea was not forced or coerced and was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. So finding that the first two Buckles factors weighed against Mr. Farrelly, the 11th Circuit concluded that the district court properly denied his motion to withdraw his plea. Mr. Farrelly also challenged the substantive reasonableness of his 30-year sentence. And according to the court, it was well below the maximum sentence of life and is not one of the rare sentences resulting from an abuse of very broad discretion. So case affirmed. Our seventh case today is United States v. Garza. This is an 11th Circuit unpublished decision that was released January 17, 2023. And Garza is a safety valve case, and Mr. Garza pled guilty to conspiracy to distribute and possess with intent to distribute 50 grams or more of methamphetamine and a few other distribution of methamphetamine counts. His guideline range ended up being 87 to 108 months with a 10-year mandatory minimum. So his guidelines became 120 months. Mr. Garza requested safety valve relief to get under that mandatory minimum. Under Section 5C1.2 of the guidelines, and under 18 U.S.C. Section 3553F. Now the fifth requirement for the safety valve, known as a tell-all provision, requires that the defendant truthfully provide to the government all information and evidence he has about the offense before the sentencing hearing. Mr. Garza met with case agents before sentencing, and he told them that he was the source of the meth and he would discuss this conspiracy. He refused, however, to discuss any other conspiracy or any other criminal conduct. So the government objected to applying the safety valve because Mr. Garza refused to tell them who supplied him with the meth, and he refused to provide any other information about his supplier. So basically, Mr. Garza was trying to protect his supplier, or maybe he was afraid of his supplier and didn't want to out who gave him the meth. So the government listed several specific questions that Mr. Garza refused to answer. And Mr. Garza's response was that the government's questions were outside the scope of the charged conspiracy, and they related to prior conspiracies. He claimed that he was the source of the meth for this particular conspiracy. So basically, he's trying to narrow the scope of the conspiracy to a time frame that begins after he received the meth from the supplier. The government argued that the supplier of the meth charged in this conspiracy is part of the conspiracy. The district court agreed with the government, finding that Mr. Garza wasn't claiming that he actually cooked up the batch of meth and that he had an obligation to tell the government where that meth came from in order to be eligible for the safety valve. Under United States v. Johnson, a defendant has an affirmative duty to truthfully disclose all information and evidence that he has about the offense and all relevant conduct. This is very broad language. And the 11th Circuit held here that Mr. Garza did not meet his burden in providing the required information. He refused to disclose any information about how he obtained the meth, and the 11th Circuit has already rejected this argument in United States v. Camacho, that the source of the meth for one conspiracy was part of a previous conspiracy. Camacho held that a defendant's refusal to reveal his source of the drugs disqualifies him from the safety valve relief. Case affirmed. Our eighth case today is United States v. Lane. This is an 11th Circuit unpublished decision that was released January 20th, 2023. Lane is a career offender case involving a mailing threatening communications and threatening to use weapons of mass destruction case. Mr. Lane was in state prison when he sent letters to a state attorney's office that included a white substance, and the letter stated, quote, "Why don't you inhale this powder and die? Maybe it's anthrax, who knows? F you, die, 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 ha, 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 anthrax, goodbye," end quote. The substance later tested negative for anthrax, and Mr. Lane was indicted in federal court. He pled guilty, and he was classified in the PSR as a career offender under Section 4B1.1 because the instant offense was a crime of violence, and he had at least two prior felony convictions for crimes of violence, according to the PSR. In fact, the PSR listed three potential qualifying offenses, which included a Florida robbery, a Florida aggravated battery, and a federal mailing threatening letters. Mr. Lane objected, arguing that only his prior robbery conviction was a proper predicate offense for career offender purposes. He did concede that Turner v. Warden Coleman, an 11th Circuit case, has previously held that a Florida aggravated battery conviction is a violent felony for armed career criminal purposes, and the definition of a crime of violence is nearly identical as it applies to both the career offender provision and the armed career criminal provision. But Mr. Lane argued that Turner was wrongly decided, and it was decided under a different statute, and it didn't specifically address his argument that Florida's aggravated battery statute only requires a reckless mens rea, which is insufficient to qualify as a crime of violence. But the 11th Circuit said no dice. Turner is directly on point, and under 11th Circuit case law, Florida aggravated battery is a crime of violence. There are two prongs to Florida's aggravated battery statute. The first involves the intentional or knowing causation of great bodily harm, and the second involves the use of a deadly weapon. Under either prong, the 11th Circuit determined that both prongs has an element, the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force against the person of another, which is the definition of a crime of violence under Section 4B1.2, subsection A1. The court also found that Florida's aggravated battery statute requires more than mere recklessness. Rather, it requires only intentional conduct. It must be more than recklessness. So with the robbery conviction and the aggravated battery conviction qualifying Mr. Lane for career offender status, the court didn't have to get to the mailing threatening letters conviction. So case affirmed. Our ninth case today is United States v. Chiara Moreno. This is an 11th Circuit unpublished decision that was released January 18, 2023. And Chiara Moreno is a minor role in a drug conspiracy case. Mr. Chiara Moreno pled guilty to conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute 1 kilo or more of heroin. His guideline range was 87 to 108 months, and he was safety valve eligible, so there was no 10-year mandatory minimum. He objected to the PSR, arguing that he should be assessed a reduction for playing a minor role in the conspiracy under Section 3B1.2 because he was merely a courier transporting the drugs. The government argued that he was an average participant and therefore not entitled to the minor role reduction. The record showed that Mr. Chiara Moreno would travel from Chicago to Florida to pick up money and would bring it back to Chicago. And he would also bring heroin down from Chicago to Florida. He was directly under the main co-conspirator. The district court overruled his objection, finding that he was responsible for 11 kilos, it was not a one-time transaction, he was a trusted member of the conspiracy, and he had authority to hold on to the kilos and to transport the drugs and the money. The district court did not see a tremendous distinction between Mr. Quijada Moreno's role and the other co-conspirators' roles. A Section 3B1.2 minor role reduction requires that the defendant is substantially less culpable than the average participant in the criminal activity. The defendant has the burden of proving his role by a preponderance of the evidence. And under the guidelines, there are factors for the court to consider, and those include the degree to which the defendant understood the scope and structure of the criminal activity, the degree to which the defendant participated in planning or organizing the criminal activity, the degree to which the defendant exercised decision-making authority or influenced the exercise of decision-making authority, the nature and extent of the defendant's participation in the commission of the criminal activity, including the acts the defendant performed, and the responsibility and discretion the defendant had in performing those acts, and the degree to which the defendant stood to benefit from the criminal activity. Utilizing these factors, the 11th Circuit determined that the district court did not err in denying Mr. Moreno's objection. He was responsible for the 11 kilos, he had a similar role to the other participants, and he played a critical role in the conspiracy. However, the court didn't really get into the nuts and bolts on how his role was similar to the other co-conspirators or the discretion that he actually held. But the court has previously held that the fact that a defendant is a courier alone will not determine whether a minor participant role applies in and of itself. So here, the court determined that the district court did not err in denying Mr. Quijada Moreno's objection to the minor role reduction. Case affirmed. Our 10th case today is Watson v. United States. This is an 11th Circuit unpublished decision that was released January 17, 2023. And Watson is a 2255 motion case involving a failure to file a motion to suppress issue. Mr. Watson pled guilty to possessing meth and marijuana with intent to distribute and to possessing a firearm in furtherance of a drug trafficking crime. He now appeals the denial of his post-conviction relief 2255 motion, where he claimed that his attorney was ineffective for failing to challenge the traffic stop and evidence seized during that traffic stop. The district court summarily denied the motion, finding that it was barred by his guilty plea and finding that it failed on the merits. On appeal, the 11th Circuit noted that although a defendant waives all jurisdictional challenges to the constitutionality of a conviction, a defendant doesn't voluntarily and knowingly plead guilty if counsel was ineffective. So the issue here was whether Mr. Watson entered a voluntary and knowing plea based on effective assistance of counsel. If Mr. Watson's claim that his Fourth Amendment rights were violated is not viable, then there was no ineffective assistance of counsel. And here the 11th Circuit agreed with the district court that the search and seizure was constitutional. Mr. Watson, after being stopped for a traffic violation, appeared nervous. He had a suspended license. He admitted that he had previously been arrested for trafficking methamphetamine, and he had boxes of sandwich bags on the car floorboard. As innocent as that sounds, the 11th Circuit held that these four facts together rose to the level of reasonable suspicion to believe that Mr. Watson had contraband in the car. So the court held that the officer acted lawfully by placing Mr. Watson in the back of a police car and waiting 45 minutes for a canine unit to arrive. The court specifically noted that it doesn't matter how long it would take to issue a citation for the driving with a suspended license. The four facts that led to reasonable suspicion justified that 45-minute detention. So in the 11th Circuit, it is not a good idea to drive around with sandwich bags in your car. Case affirmed. Our 11th case today, and continuing with a string of difficult-to-pronounce case names, is United States v. Yeliniemi, an 11th Circuit unpublished decision that was released January 18, 2023. And this is a case about the defendant's decision whether or whether not to testify. Mr. Yeliniemi was charged with multiple child pornography offenses, and he decided to proceed to trial. At the close of the government's case, the district court addressed both the attorney and Mr. Yeliniemi and stated that it was his decision and his decision alone whether or not he would testify. So he said that he was torn between testifying and not testifying, and he asked for more time to think about it. He said he wanted to spend one more night with his family, but he didn't explain how that impacted his decision whether or whether not to testify. So the district judge gave Mr. Yeliniemi 15 minutes to discuss his decision with his attorney. About 20 minutes later, Mr. Yeliniemi told the district judge that he decided that he was going to testify, and the district judge reiterated that it was a decision that only he could make. The district court then went through a colloquy with Mr. Yeliniemi about his right to testify or not to testify, and Mr. Yeliniemi decided that he was going to testify, and he took the stand and denied receiving child pornography, despite a taped confession that he claimed he gave only because the investigator told him he would not go to jail if he confessed. The jury ended up convicting him, and he was sentenced to 168 months in prison. On appeal, Mr. Yeliniemi claims that he was coerced by the district judge to make a quick decision on whether or whether not to testify. The 11th Circuit noted that a district court is generally not required to conduct any colloquy, but there is nothing to preclude it either. And here the 11th Circuit found that the district court's questions were straightforward and neutral and did not probe trial strategy issues or suggest that the court's own opinion was one way or the other. The court also determined that Mr. Yeliniemi had enough time to make his decision. He was told before jury selection earlier in the day that the government's case may be finished that day and that his decision whether or whether not to testify may come later that day. He was then provided 15 minutes when he requested more time to decide, and he never asked for any additional time once that 15 minutes was over. So based on those facts, the district court did not err. Case affirmed. And that's a wrap. I'm your host, Jeremy Lesnetsky with Lesnetsky Guy on Law, and this was another episode of the Site of the Crime podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit the like button. And if you'd like to keep up to date on all the latest criminal law cases, subscribe to the Site of the Crime. And if you like the show, please review us. This will help your colleagues find us, and they too can stay up to date. Each week, we'll release separate Florida and federal criminal law episodes with the previous week's court opinions. Look in the show notes for links to each case and for a link to the written case summaries. If you have questions or comments, please don't hesitate to shoot me an email at jeremy@lglawflorida.com. See you next time at the Site of the Crime.